Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now going to embark upon a study of Zephaniah chapter 2, which I will entitle Salvation for the Remnant. A little bit of background. Zephaniah prophesied between 640 and 621 BC for reasons I went over in the previous chapter. He is prophesying mainly against Judah, the northern kingdom of Israel, already having been destroyed in 722. And he is warning mostly in his book about the approach of the Babylonians in 586 BC when they burnt down Jerusalem and conquered Judah. So we begin now in Zephaniah 2, verses 1 through 3. Gather yourselves together, gather together, undesirable nation, before the decree takes effect and the day passes like chaff, before the burning of the Lord's anger overtakes you, before the day of the Lord's anger overtakes you. Seek the Lord, all you humble of the earth, who carry out what he commands. Seek righteousness, seek humility. Perhaps you will be concealed on the day of the Lord's anger. Now in verse 1, Zephaniah calls Judah an undesirable nation. That's quite an ironic term for God's covenant people. Undesirable nation. Gather together, undesirable nation, before the decree takes effect. What decree? The decree that God has made that Babylon's going to destroy Judah in 586. Gather together before the day passes like chaff. Chaff passes pretty fast when the wind blows it. Chaff is that part of the wheat which is blown away when the wheat is thrown up into the air. Gather together before the burning of the Lord's anger overtakes you, and the day of the Lord's anger overtakes you. That's 586. Now in verse 3, Zephaniah switches his address from the undesirable nation to the humble of the earth. Zephaniah had given up on the leaders of Israel. He was a member of the royal house, as we stated in the last chapter. He was a great-great-grandson of Hezekiah. So he knew all the leaders of Judah. He'd given up on them, and now he's speaking to the humble of the earth. Now, this humble of the earth, according to an internet commentator named Gelston, this humble of the earth is the beginning of the concept of the remnant, which we will talk about as we go through here. I entitle this chapter Salvation for the Remnant. The humble of the earth, the remnant, they carry out what God commands. They seek righteousness, they seek humility. And notice that Zephaniah says that perhaps you will be concealed on the day of the Lord's anger. The idea is judgment's coming on the undesirable nation at large, but if you keep seeking righteousness and seeking humility, perhaps you will be hidden from the wrath brought on by the coming Babylonians. Now notice that Zephaniah doesn't say it is guaranteed that you will be concealed on the day of the Lord's anger. It is a possibility, perhaps. John Gill and Matthew Henry say that perhaps means more than possible, rather probable. That might have to be determined by the subtleties of the Hebrew language, which I, of course, don't know. But at any rate, Zephaniah could not give absolute surety of protection for the righteous remnant. Not even a prophet knows all the future. Consider the implications of this for Copenhagenites, the name it and claim it, blab it and grab it, mark it and parp it, scream it and redeem it. Folks who say that all you got to do is say it, it's going to happen. Because we can control tornadoes, we can control anything just by the words of our mouth. Well, not even a canonical prophet like Zephaniah claimed that. He says, perhaps you will be concealed. There's some other scriptures that convey the same idea in the minor prophets. Amos 5:15 says this, hate evil, love good, and establish justice in the gate. Perhaps the Lord God of hosts may be gracious to the remnant of Joseph. And there's another use of the word remnant also. Joel 2:14. Who knows whether he will not turn and relent and leave a blessing behind him, even a grain offering and a drink offering for the Lord your God? Who knows whether he will not turn and relent? Faith is not knowing the future even though you believe in God. You trust God to take care of the future because he's the sovereign God who made the universe. He controls the future too, so we don't need to worry. Although I must admit, things can get so bad down here, it's real easy to see why people might worry. We go now to Zephaniah 2, verses 4 through 5. Zephaniah continues, for Gaza will be abandoned, and Ashkelon will become a ruin. Ashdod will be driven out at noon, and Ekron will be uprooted. Woe, inhabitants of the seacoast, nation of the Cherethites! The word of the Lord is against you, Canaan, land of the Philistines. I will destroy you until there is no one left. Now here, four of the five famous Philistine cities are mentioned. I have a little map here showing you where they are. If you will locate the Dead Sea as you go down the Jordan River, Jerusalem is just about 20 miles to the west of the northern tip of the Dead Sea. If you keep going another 30 miles to the Mediterranean coast or so, you hit Ashdod. That's one of the five Philistine cities. Then you go south on the Mediterranean coast for another 20 miles or so, and you hit Ashkelon. Go south from Ashkelon on the Mediterranean coast for another 20 miles, maybe 15 or 20 miles, you hit Gaza. Gaza, of course, is that famous place now that is the center of the Hamas-Israeli war, started in October the 7th, 1923. Now, on that line, going from Jerusalem to Ashdod, going from east to west, Ekron is right in the middle almost. It's a little bit closer to Ashdod. And then about 5 miles south of Ekron, you got Gath. Now, these are five Philistine cities. They appear over and over again in Old Testament history. They should be memorized in one's head. The map of these should be a picture in one's memory. Now, why was Gath not mentioned? It was one of the five cities. Why did not Zephaniah mention it? Well, that's because Gath had already been destroyed by Uzziah. It was already under the control of Judah when Zephaniah was speaking, according to John Gill. We read that in 2 Chronicles 26:6. Uzziah, who ruled from 767 to 740, that's about 100 or so years before Zephaniah, Uzziah went out to wage war against the Philistines, and he tore down the wall of Gath, the wall of Jabneh, and the wall of Ashdod. Then he built cities in the vicinity of Ashdod and among the Philistines. So Uzziah was successful against the Philistines, and that's why Gath is not mentioned. But the other four cities are, they're going down to Babylon. The Philistines were wiped out at about the same time that Jerusalem fell to the Babylonians in 586. I'm going to talk about that a little bit later, so we'll hold that thought. Ashkelon in verse 4, according to the commentator Pett, P-E-T-T, Ashkelon was seized by Nebuchadnezzar in 604. Jeremiah prophesied this, Jeremiah 47:5. I say he prophesied it, he might have written this after the fact. Baldness has come upon Gaza. Ashkelon has been ruined. O remnant of their valley, how long will you gash yourself? Gashing yourself in mourning. Jeremiah 47:7. How can it be quiet when the Lord has given it an order against Ashkelon and against the seacoast? There he has assigned it. Now, Pitt says that Nebuchadnezzar knocked off Ashkelon in 604. If we want a general date for the destruction of the Philistines, we can just say the early 600s. Wikipedia says that Ashkelon was destroyed at about the same time that Nebuchadnezzar took Judah and Syria, which was 586. The Catholic Encyclopedia says no record of the conquest has been preserved. The Jewish Encyclopedia says that when Cambyses the Persian crossed the former territory of the Philistines about 525, he described it as belonging to an Arabian, not a Philistine ruler, which means that they were gone by 525. So we'll just say around 600 or so, right about the same time that the people of Judah were destroyed by Babylon, the Philistines were destroyed also, which means, of course, that Zephaniah was correct when he said that Gaza will be abandoned and Ashkelon will become a ruin. Ashdod will be driven out at noon. Why noon? Here's some options as to what that means. Pett says that noon is at the height of the day, and likewise the Philistines will be driven out at the height of their glory. John Gill says noon refers to the fact that the Philistines will be driven out openly and publicly and with great ease. They shall have no occasion to use any secret stratagems, says Gill. Jamerson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the Philistines were driven out suddenly and unexpectedly because Orientals usually sleep in the heat of the noonday sun. And all of a sudden, wake up, the Philistines are coming. And all of a sudden, wake up, the Babylonians are coming. I like Gill's answer the best. The Babylonians are coming at noon, openly, publicly, where everybody can see it, and there's no stopping them using a nighttime ambush or a nighttime conspiracy. Now, in verse 5, the Philistines are called inhabitants of the seacoast because that's where they lived, down there on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea. They're also called the nation of the Cherethites. Now, that word's used a lot in the Old Testament. The Cherethites were probably a segment of the Philistines with roots in Crete, the island of Crete. That's what most of the old commentators say. That's what most of everybody says. The Bible Encyclopedia that you might consult, Cherethites are just the people from whom the Philistines came, probably from Crete. Now in verse 5, Zephaniah says, "The word of the Lord is against you, Canaan, land of the Philistines." Well, that's not referring to the whole land of Canaan. It's referring to the part of Canaan where the Philistine cities were, along the seacoast, and inland a little bit at Ekron and Gath. "I will destroy you until there's no one left." The Philistines, of course, eventually passed out from history. I think it was right when Babylon wiped them out. Now let's go to Zephaniah 2, verses 6 through 7. Zephaniah continues, "The seacoast will become pasture lands with caves for shepherds and folds for sheep. The coastland will belong to the remnant of the house of Judah. They will find pasture there. They will lie down in the evening among the houses of Ashkelon, for the Lord their God will return to them and restore their fortunes." Again, we have mention of the remnant in verse 7. Because in the midst of all the destruction, God's going to preserve a remnant because he must keep his covenant promise alive. He has to judge because of his justice, but because of his mercy, he keeps a remnant alive. In verse 6, the seacoast, that's the land of the Philistines, it will have protection, pasture lands for the sheep and caves for the shepherd, folds for the sheep in the pasture land. So the point is there'll be safety. Now, when did this remnant possess Philistia? Two options. Option number one, on the return from Babylon in 538. Barnes, Benson, Poole, and Pulpit all hold to that option. Option number two, in the times of the Maccabees in the 2nd century B.C., John Gill holds to that option. I just think it's easy to say that it refers to the return from Babylonia in 538. We proceed now to Zephaniah 2, verses 8 through 11. Now, this is Yahweh speaking through Zephaniah. "I have heard the taunting of Moab and the insults of the Ammonites, who have taunted my people and threatened their territory. Therefore, as I live," and that's an oath taken by God, "therefore, as I live, this is the declaration of the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel. Moab will be like Sodom and the Ammonites like Gomorrah, a place overgrown with weeds, a salt pit, and a perpetual wasteland. The remnant of my people will plunder them. The remainder of my nation will dispossess them. This is what they get for their pride, because they have taunted and acted arrogantly against the people of the Lord of hosts. The Lord will be terrifying to them when he starves all the gods of the earth. Then all the distant coastlands of the nations will bow and worship to him, each in his own place." Now, Moab, of course, is that country that's due east of the Dead Sea, and then Ammon is due north of Moab, to the east of the Jordan River, roughly. The taunting and insults of the Ammonites that God mentions are everywhere in the Old Testament. As Pett puts it, Moab and Ammon had a record of constant enmity against Israel. I'm not going to read you all the passages, but I'll give you the citations. Numbers 22, 24, and 17. Judges 3, 12 through 14. Judges 10, 7 through 9. Judges 11, 4 through 6. 1 Samuel 11, 1 through 11. 2 Samuel 10, 1 through 14. 2 Kings 3, Jeremiah 49, 1. Just to give you an idea of how much Moab and Ammon show up as being an enemy of Israel. Moab and Ammon always worked closely together with first one and then the other in ascendancy. So Moab and Ammon are going to end up like Sodom and Gomorrah. Sodom and Gomorrah, of course, was in Moab. And if you look at Sodom and Gomorrah on Google Maps, you will see desolation, desert, a place overgrown with weeds, a salt pit. Lots of salt down there, south of the Dead Sea, a perpetual wasteland. It's still there today, a perpetual wasteland. Now, when did Moab and Ammon go down to the Babylonians? John Gill says it's about 5 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, which would put it about 581. That's when Nebuchadnezzar made war upon the Ammonites and Moabites. Now, Wikipedia thinks that there is now evidence to contradict that. Let me read you what they say about the fall of Ammon. "Archaeology and history indicate that Ammon flourished during the period of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, 626 to 539. This contradicts the view dominant for decades that Transjordan was either destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar II, and Transjordan, of course, would include Ammon and Moab, or the Transjordan suffered a rapid decline following Judah's destruction by that king in 586. Newer evidence suggests that Ammon enjoyed continuity from the Neo-Babylonian to the Persian period of 550 to 530. Well, I don't know what this new evidence is. The dominant view is that Ammon and Moab went down right after the Jews went down in 586. And so Zephaniah has prophesied accurately, assuming that option is true. Now, another option as to when Moab and Ammon could be weeds in a salt pit, that could have occurred when the Romans conquered the Levant by Pompey the general in 63 BC. Wikipedia says at that time Ammon lost its distinct identity through assimilation. Either way, God is protecting the remnant of the Jews by whacking their enemies. Now, it's one thing to protect the remnant, but Zephaniah goes further. In verse 9, he says, "The remnant of my people will plunder them," plunder the Moabites and the Ammonites. "The remainder of my nation," that's the remnant, "will dispossess them." Now, that's saying something more. The Jews are actually going to conquer the Ammonites and the Moabites. Now, two of the major prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel, had already promised that Moab and Ammon would be destroyed, just like Zephaniah has done. Jeremiah 48:42 says, "Moab will be destroyed from being a people because he has become arrogant toward the Lord." And Ezekiel in chapter 25, verse 7 says, "Therefore, behold, I have stretched out my hand against you, Ammon, and I will give you for spoil to the nations, and I will cut you off from the peoples and make you perish from the lands. I will destroy you. Thus you will know that I am the Lord." But again, now the remnant in verse 9 will plunder and dispossess these pagan nations. Well, let's look at two options as to when that might have occurred. Option number one, the Jews plundered and dispossessed, the remnant of the Jews plundered and dispossessed the Ammonites and Moabites under the Maccabees, which is 2nd century B.C. John Gill, the public commentary, hold to that opinion. Colin Delitzsch vehemently denies it. Public commentary says that, yes, it was the Maccabees, but the prophecy of Zephaniah was ultimately fulfilled under the Messiah when the new Judah, the new Israel, plunders the nations by getting them converted. That's Colin Delitzsch's position, too. We'll look at that in a minute. But apparently Moab and Ammon had risen to great powers after the destruction by Babylon, assuming the old view is correct. Josephus describes the conquest of Moab and Ammon by Babylonia in his Antiquities, but Pet disputes that fulfillment. He says the people the Maccabeans conquered weren't the same as the Moabites and the Ammonites. So you see there's a lot of fuzziness here about exactly when the remnant plundered and dispossessed the Ammonites and the Moabites. Was it the Maccabees, option number one? How about option number two? The plundering took place when the Jews are converted to Christ in our future, the future of Colin Delitzsch and the future of us too. Actually, Colin Delitzsch was 19th century. I'm going to read you a long quote from Colin Delitzsch, and this illustrates the perennial problem of interpreting these prophecies. There are usually three options. Option number one, the prophecy has a local fulfillment. A fulfillment referring to the political situation of the nation that's being prophesied against, usually in a near term, maybe half a century or so, maybe a century or so. That's option number one. Option number two, the prophecy has a fulfillment in the Christian church at the first coming of Jesus. And option number three, the prophecy has a fulfillment at the second coming, or right before the second coming of Jesus in the far future. Well, this here is a prophecy by Zephaniah, according to Colin Delitzsch, which will be fulfilled when people are converted to Christ. I need to remind us of what the prophecy said. "The remnant of my people will plunder the Ammonites and the Moabites. The remainder of my nation, the remnant, will dispossess them." All right, so let's see what Colin Delitzsch says about the fulfillment of this prophecy. "The fulfillment or realization of the threat pronounced upon Philistia, Moab, and Ammon," and notice Colin Delitzsch include Philistia in this, "the fulfillment we have not to look for in the particular historical occurrences through which these tribes were conquered and subjugated by the Chaldeans." Well, we've already talked about that, and I think most people think that that's exactly what Zephaniah is talking about, the conquering of Judah by the Chaldeans. Kylan Delitzsch says no. And to some extent by the Jews after the captivity until they eventually vanished from the stage of history. The Jews after the captivity would be the Maccabees. We've mentioned that too. These events can only come into consideration as preliminary stages of the fulfillment, which Zephaniah completely passes by since he only views the judgment in its ultimate fulfillment. We are precluded, moreover, from taking the words as relating to that event by the circumstance that neither Philistia on the one hand nor Moabites and Ammonites on the other were ever taken permanent possession of by the Jews, and still less were they ever taken by Judah as the nation of God for his own property. In other words, it never happened that Judah physically plundered Moab and Ammon. Not even the Maccabees did that, according to Kylan Delitzsch. Judah is not to enter into such possession as this till the Lord turns the captivity of Judah. That is to say, not immediately after the return from the Babylonish captivity, but when the dispersion of Israel among the Gentiles, which lasts till this day, shall come to an end, and Israel, through its conversion to Christ, be reinstated in the privileges of the people of God. It follows from this that the fulfillment is still in the future, and that it will be accomplished not literally, but spiritually, in the utter destruction of the nations referred to as heathen nations, and opponents of the kingdom of God, and in the incorporation of those who are converted to the living God at the time of the judgment into the citizenship of the spiritual Israel. Spiritual Israel, of course, is the church, the citizenship of the spiritual Israel. That's when this prophecy is being fulfilled, all through the church age, according to Kylan Delitzsch. And, of course, it could be both. The plundering of the land by the Maccabees could be a type of the expansion of Judah, the plundering of Judah, spiritually done in the New Testament era by the church. Well, however it was done, it was fitting that Israel should possess the land of the Moabites and the Edomites after they had encroached upon the Israelites' territory, become arrogant against Israel. Here's another prophecy against Moab and the Ammonites. Isaiah 11:12-14. He will lift up a banner for the nations and gather the dispersed of Israel. He will collect the scattered of Judah from the four corners of the earth. That's God that's going to do this. Ephraim's envy will cease. Judah's harassment will end. Ephraim will no longer be envious of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. But they will swoop down on the Philistine flank to the west. Together they will plunder the people of the east. They will extend their power over Edom and Moab, and the Ammonites will be their subjects. Now, we read about the state of mind of the Ammonites and Moabites after the Lord does this, whenever he does it. Verse 11, the Lord will be terrifying to them when he starves all the gods of the earth. How can God starve a god? How can the Lord Yahweh starve a god? By depriving the gods of their sacrifices, because the gods are said to eat those sacrifices, but the gods are being destroyed. Their temple idols are being torn down as the Babylonians come in and wipe out Ammon and Moab. The Lord will be terrifying to them when he starves all the gods of the earth. That word is Haaretz, which, of course, is almost a technical expression for the land, but here I believe it's the earth. Most all of my translations say so, except for the Young's literal translation, because we're talking about gods outside the land of Israel. We're talking about Ammon and Moab. I don't think he means every idol everywhere in the world. I think he's talking specifically about Ammon and Moab. And the end of verse 11, Zephaniah says, then all the distant coastlands of the nations will bow and worship to him. Coastlands is that familiar word. Sometimes it's translated as islands. And so if you look all around the Mediterranean Sea, you will see coastlands, the coast of countries that were trading with Israel, and then the islands right off the coastlands. Islands are everywhere in the Mediterranean Sea. This is what Isaac Newton says, the famous physicist. He's quoted in Benson. By the earth, the Jews understood the great continent of all Asia and Africa. In other words, all the gods of the earth. Isaac Newton says that what the Jews were thinking when they would hear gods of the earth, they would understand the great continent of all Asia and Africa, to which they had access by land. By the isles of the sea, that's the coastlands, they understood the places to which they sailed by sea, particularly all Europe, basically the Mediterranean basin. Now, the word nations is used in verse 11. Then all the distant coastlands of the nations will bow to God. Who are these nations? Futurists, such as Pet. say that the nations, all those nations at the end of the world who will bend their knee to Jesus, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord at the end of the world. Whereas Barnes, Benson, and Benson quotes the famous golden tongue orator Chrysostom, those commentators believe that the nations here refer to the spread of the gospel to the nations. Then all the distant coastlands of the nations will bow in worship as the gospel is spread. I don't see how this could really be fulfilled in any other way, because when did Asia or Africa or Europe, when did they ever bow down to Yahweh, except when they began converting to Christ? Then they bowed down to Yahweh, but before that, I don't know when that ever happened. We go now to Zephaniah 2, verse 12. Zephaniah says, "You also, O Ethiopians, will be slain by my sword." Now, Nebuchadnezzar conquered Ethiopia when he conquered Egypt, and Egypt was conquered by Babylon in 568, according to MedCraveOnline.com. I think that's a common date. I've seen it before. That's just a few years after the conquering of Jerusalem by Babylon, 19 years later. I read an account of this attack by Nebuchadnezzar on Egypt. Nebuchadnezzar actually killed an Egyptian pharaoh during this attack, so it's sort of well known. And I think we assume that Ethiopia, which is right to the south of Egypt, it was conquered also by Nebuchadnezzar at the same time. So Ethiopia goes down. This was also predicted by two of the major prophets, Jeremiah and Ezekiel. Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 46, verse 9, "Go up, you horses, and drive madly, you chariots, that the mighty men may march forward, Ethiopia and Put that handle the shield." I'm assuming here that Ethiopia is an ally of Egypt that's about to go down to the Babylonians. Ezekiel 30, verse 4, "A sword will come upon Egypt, and anguish will be in Ethiopia when the slain fall in Egypt." So it looks like that Egypt and Ethiopia went down at the same time. And I am going to assume that happened when Egypt was conquered by Babylon in 568. So Zephaniah chapter 2, verse 12 says, "You also, O Ethiopians, will be slain by my sword." We can assume that's what happened. And Zephaniah was entirely correct. Now we go to Zephaniah 2, verses 13 through 15, and we will finish this chapter. "He," that's Yahweh, Zephaniah is speaking now, "He," Yahweh, "will also stretch out his hand against the north and destroy Assyria. He will make Nineveh a desolate ruin, dry as the desert. Herds will lie down in the middle of it, every kind of wild animal. Both the desert owl and the screech owl will roost in the capitals of its pillars. Their calls will sound from the window, but devastation will be on the threshold, for he will expose the cedar work. This is the self-assured city that lives in security, that thinks for herself, 'I exist and there is no one else.' What a desolation she has become, a place for wild animals to lie down. Everyone who passes by her jeers and shakes his fist." So this is the prophecy of the desolation of Nineveh. This is real easy to know when this occurred because it's a firm historical date, 612 BC. Nineveh was destroyed by the Medes and the Babylonians. Now, Nineveh has a whole bunch of ruins in the present Iraqi city of Mosul on the Tigris River. There's an immense area of ruins. Some of these ruins are overlaid by suburbs of the city of Mosul. Henry Layard, I think his name was, from the British Museum, discovered all of these ruins in the 19th century. It's a great story. Nineveh was on the eastern side of the Tigris River, according to the Library of Congress. It was on an important trade route running between the Mediterranean and the Indian Ocean. So Nineveh was a big city. Of course, it was also the capital of the feared empire of the Assyrians. Nahum, of course, spent his whole book prophesying against Nineveh. Jonah did too, for that matter. So Nineveh was wiped out in 612, destroyed by the Medes and the Babylonians. Here's what Wikipedia says of this destruction, how Wikipedia describes Nineveh becoming a desolate ruin, as Zephaniah says. "Before the excavations in the 1800s, historical knowledge of the great Assyrian Empire and of its magnificent capital was almost wholly a blank. Vague memories had indeed survived of its power and greatness, but very little was definitely known. Other cities that had perished, such as Palmyra, that's in Syria, Persepolis, that's in Persia, and Thebes, that's in Egypt, those cities had left ruins to mark their sites and tell of their former greatness. But of this city, imperial Nineveh, not a single vestige seemed to remain. and the very place on which it had stood become only matter of conjecture. Now that's a desolate ruin when there are no remains of it left that you can find. They got built over. Wikipedia continues, in the days of the Greek historian Herodotus, 400 BC, Nineveh had become a thing of the past, and when Xenophon the historian passed the place in the retreat of the 10,000, the very memory of its name had been lost. It was buried out of sight. So with that in mind, let's read verses 14 and 15 again. Herds will lie down in the middle of it, every kind of wild animal. There's no city. Both the desert owl and the screech owl will roost in the capitals of its pillars. Well, it got even worse than that. There weren't any pillars to see. Eventually, as Nineveh sank into the dirt, their calls will sound from the window, calls for help, but devastation will be on the threshold, right at the door. For he, Yahweh, will expose the cedar work of the nice palaces of Nineveh on the inside are going to be exposed to the enemy in 612 when the Babylonians and Medes came. This is the self-assured city that lives in security, that thinks to herself, I exist and there's no one else. Nineveh was a very proud place. What a desolation she has become, a place for wild animals to lie down. Everyone who passes by her jeers and shakes his fist. So Zephaniah was right about Nineveh. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished chapter 2 of Zephaniah. We are now prepared to go to chapter 3, which I will call Judgment on Jerusalem and Conversion of the Nations. I hope you stay tuned for that discussion, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.